Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
All right, the big topic coming out of the Astros' 13-inning loss to the Dodgers the other night was Dusty Baker's strategy of not bunting to move the runner over from second base, the automatic runner the Astros got in all four of those innings, not using a sacrifice bunt to put a runner on third with less than two outs that could then be brought home with a ground ball or a fly ball potentially to win the game. Just to reset this, here was Dusty Baker's explanation post-game when asked the question by our Adam Spillane.
Dusty, did you think about bunting with Toro after Correa tied the game in the 11th?
Yeah, I thought about it, but if I bunt, then it's up to, it'd have been up to, to Straw, I think. I thought about it, but, with the hitters that we have here, I mean, who's up against Floro? Was it Altuve?
No, I'm talking about Toro after Correa tied the game in the 11th.
No, but he wasn't up there to, he wasn't up there. But if I was going to do anything, I might have left Dubs in the bunt, but no, I didn't think about that. I mean, they didn't bunt, we didn't bunt, nobody bunted. And so, I thought I liked the matchup, with Toro, up there, and that's what he's here for.
All right, so this had a lot of people very upset yesterday. I was listening to John and Landry after our show, and the thought of bunting crossed my mind a few times in extra innings, but look, in the 10th inning, I would let Altuve swing away too. He's Altuve. In the 11th inning, Dusty let Gurriel swing the bat. They were down by a run at that time. But in the 11th inning, he didn't bunt the potential tying run over. I would think the tying run would be almost as important as getting the winning run in. You just need a run to keep the game going. And Gurriel gets a base hit and starts a little rally for them. And then I think maybe a lot of people were angry with Dusty that he didn't sacrifice in the 11th once they had runners on first and second with nobody out, move the runners over, try and use Toro to do that. So there were a lot of people angry about this. John and Landry spent a lot of time on it yesterday, and understandably so. It's the topic that had a lot of people talking coming out of that game. And Seth, I'm glad that Jason Stark of The Athletic did this. He went and found the numbers that are excruciating to go find.
It's excruciating to go find. And then, frankly, yeah, when you start looking at the different scenarios, there's a lot of numbers.
There's a lot of numbers. But here's what I would point out when we're talking about the criticism being aimed specifically at Dusty Baker. That if you're going to aim it at Dusty Baker, as it turns out, you probably need to aim it at baseball in general more than you do Dusty Baker. And it could appear that maybe you're arguing and paddling upstream in this argument because there have been seven extra inning games so far going into last night in which obviously that opportunity to bunt the runner over is available in every half inning of those games. There has been one sacrifice bunt in the major leagues in extra innings so far this year through seven games. So Dusty's not alone with this strategy. These teams have reams of data about what to do. If you don't think Dusty isn't programmed to do certain things in these situations by a team like the Astros, it has an analytics department that's several people deep, you're crazy. And even in the minor leagues, Seth, Jason Stark points out, even in the minor leagues where this rule has been around forever, this is the rule that they've been playing with, not forever, but for the last couple of years it's been around in the minor leagues. Situationally, the peak of teams bunting, situationally is the bottom half of an inning where the game is tied, even then teams are only bunting like 30% of the time.
It's right, which in the arguments for bunting in these situations in extra innings, especially with a guy in second base, obviously, is that you're not trying to get, if you're not bunting in the third inning, then obviously it's because you're trying to get as many runs as possible and you're reducing those overall chances. So people keep saying, yeah, but all you need is one run here. All you need is one run. Yeah, that's the problem. It's still, the math still works out when you factor in that you have to have a successful bunt You have to have a successful bunt for your strategy of bunting to work out. And guys just don't bunt that much anymore.
Yeah.
Because of all the analytics and because there's less and less of it, guys don't bunt that much anymore. So it's going to be harder to have a successful bunt, too. On top of that, you add that the odds aren't really with you anyway. And that's pretty much just where you're at. And like, it's a whole lot of – if you're going to scream about decisions that Dusty Baker makes – really what you're arguing about here is a whole philosophical sea
yes.
change in the game of baseball. If what you're worried about is that, oh, wow, Dusty Baker isn't sharp because he chose not to sack bunt in extra innings last night, that's just not – it's not a valid argument. There's other things you can criticize in terms of pitching choices or what have you, but Dusty Baker did pretty much the exact same thing that every other manager in the league, whether he's a 28-year-old math genius or an 80-year-old wine connoisseur, they're going to make that same decision.
Yeah, you're arguing that all of baseball is stupid.
Right.
And who knows? It may very well be. I don't know. But that's what you're arguing. The channel of your rage, I guess, should be channeled at Dusty because he's the manager of your baseball team. You know, the Astros are the team that you care about the most. But the fact of the matter is he wasn't doing something where the rest of baseball was sitting there going, what the hell are you doing, Dusty? Like, he was doing what teams do nowadays. And, Seth, I would even argue, it's interesting you bring that up, like the argument that the bunt enthusiasts are putting forth, like, you just need one run. To me, then, I'll take it a step further and go, well, then shouldn't you bunt every time you get a leadoff double in an inning, right? If you could get one run per inning, that's a killer game of baseball right there. Like,
that's all you need.
Shouldn't then, right? Shouldn't then, if any opportunity comes across to push across such an automatic run that a runner on second with nobody out seems to be, shouldn't you be doing that every time? Forget about just the 10th, 11th, 12th inning. Shouldn't you be doing that in the fifth inning when someone hits a leadoff double? Shouldn't you be just universally laying down a sack bunt so you can go get that one run that all these bunt enthusiasts seem to see as so automatic?
Well, this is the problem, is because now we hardly see bunting anymore, so we've forgotten it in our minds. It's always a successful bunt. Like, oh, yeah, just get on up there and bunt. No big deal. Yeah. It's a little bit like in football where you feel it in your gut, right? Just like you feel it in your gut, like, hey, bunt here. It's awesome because you're envisioning it, right?
Right?
In football, when you get down to the goal line, why didn't you just run it in? I can't believe you didn't run it in. Why don't you run it in? And then, God forbid, the coach run it three times in a row and get stuffed.
You're
like,
predictable.
Oh, what a moron.
So
what a predictable fool. Jeez.
Seth, this article is interesting because Jason Stark does a really deep dive on what this new extra inning rule means. And I'll be honest with you, we've only been through one of these so far with the Astros. I like it more than I thought I would. Like, it's very, it is fun to debate some of this strategy, even if I'm firmly on one side of it. And I found it to be very tense right away. Like, there was no burn-in period for the extra inning tension. Like, it's tense immediately and it feels really cool. But he starts talking about some of the strategic ideas that managers could use. And I can't go through all of them here, but the one that was really interesting to me was the very first one he brings up. Because we know that the rule is the runner that gets put on second is the player who's in front of the leadoff hitter that inning in the batting order. You know, so in other words, if your eight-hole hitter is the guy who's leading off the 10th inning, whoever is batting in the seventh hole is the guy that gets put on second base. So as much of a premium as speed is for that guy, he brings up this scenario of an intentional strikeout in the ninth inning.
Yeah.
What if a guy like Billy Hamilton is up? And Billy Hamilton, I guess, is a really fast person. Billy Hamilton is up with two outs in the ninth. You got nobody on base, and it's a tie game. You might say, hey, Billy, strike out on purpose here so we can put you on second to try to start the 10th. Stark says, don't snicker. This could actually happen. I could totally see that happening where you go, you know what? It's not like Billy Hamilton is starting a rally for us here. Let's just punt, hope that our relievers keep this other team off the board in the top of the 10th and get our speedy guy on base basically for free.
It's like letting a guy score intentionally in football.
A little bit.
Doing that annoying thing where
I'm going to
make it about football every time. Well, okay, but this is the key.
Yeah.
What if, let's say, Osuna recognizes what's going on here. Oh, okay, this Billy Hamilton character, he ain't even trying.
He beans him.
I'm going to plunk him. I mean, you could do the intent. Are you allowed to do the intentional walk like two pitches into a?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Yeah,
it's like declining a penalty. I decline your strikeout. You must try.
Billy Hamilton whiffs obviously twice. Right. Like swings the bat as the ball's releasing. So Osuna decides to just intentionally walk.
But let's play this out with what it would look like for the Astros real quick here, Seth. Nobody on base. Bottom of the ninth. Miles Straw is at the plate, and he's batting in the eight hole like he was the other night.
Yeah,
and the catcher spot is after him. Would you rather have Miles Straw up there trying to get on base for Martin Maldonado, or would you rather have Miles Straw on second to start the 10th inning, presumably for maybe a pinch hitter if Martin comes back to earth anytime soon, and then the top of the order? Like, right. I think I'd rather play my cards going to the 10th inning.
I would
get Straw on base
too.
For free on the second, on second base.
So I'm looking at that closer, and he recognizes what Miles Straw is doing, so he decides, I'm going to intentionally walk him. You're already two pitches into it, so you're not allowed to just do the premeditated intentional walk. So what will happen is the catcher is going to set up way to the outside, and Straw's still going to swing at it as the ball's way away from him.
Well, as
it's
you know,
glorious.
Seth, the game has gotten softer now because they don't even do that anymore. Now it's just you get to take your pace.
No, that's my point. I don't think you can do that two strikes into.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Into the pitch.
I got you.
So like then the catcher's going to set up old school way outside, and Straw'll still swing anyway.
I got you. All right, Springer, Brantley, Yuli. I put up a poll yesterday on Twitter. Here's the scenario. They're all free agents after the season. That is true. I asked the people, pick one of those three at their current salary for the next two seasons. Who did the people choose, and did they get it right? We'll talk about it next. So I put up a poll yesterday on Twitter, and got thinking about this. They were talking on the broadcast the other night about how, man, the whole Astros outfield, all free agents. Yuli's a free agent. The Astros have some work to do this offseason. I get it, we're only six games into the restarted or the truncated season. But it is fun, a little harrowing to think about some of these things, especially once guys are starting to put their years together here. It's only six games in, so there's still a lot of baseball to be played. But my question, Seth, to Astro fans was this. You can keep only one of these pending free agents for the next two seasons after this year. So for 2021 and 2022, you can keep just one of these three guys, and you get to do it at their current annual salary. And the three players are George Springer, who makes $21 million this year. So you'd get him 2 years, $42 million for the next two seasons. Michael Brantley makes $15 million this year. So you'd get Michael Brantley for 2 years, $30 million. Yuli Gurriel makes $8.3 million this year. So you would get Yuli, who's the oldest of the three, at 2 years, $16.6 million. The people have spoken on this. And Seth, before I get to the people, what would Seth Payne vote if he were to vote in this poll?
Look, George Springer is the heart and soul of the team, mm-hmm. as everybody knows by now. George Springer is lovable. George Springer is just he's the guy that you would want your son to be in playing baseball, except maybe the whole 2017, you know, whatever. But as far as all of that goes, that like he is the ideal baseball player. But I have to go based on the cold, hard stats and the numbers and the statistics. So my argument is George Springer had the highest WAR out of any of them. Like, so I'll go by WAR and WAR alone. Last year, the Fangraphs WAR, George Springer had 6.5, where Yuli was down at 3.2. Brantley, 4.2.
Yeah.
So I'll go with Springer. And Springer is, let's see, younger than Brantley, younger than Yuli.
Youngest than three, yeah.
Yeah, I'll take Springer.
The people agree with you. 52% of the people say Springer. I'm surprised the number wasn't a little higher, and maybe there's, you know how, you know, Twitter reacts. They probably think George Springer is there's probably a big chunk of Twitter that thinks Springer's washed up because of the first six games of the season, that kind of thing. Springer, 52%. Brantley, 35%. I was a little surprised Yuli only got 13%. I thought he might get a little more vote, maybe at the expense of Brantley. I'll say this, two things. I'll give you my take on this, but just to follow up on your Springer point, I do think of these three guys, if they were available at these prices, that the Astros would probably take Springer. Like, I think if the Astros could get Springer for another 2 years at $42 million total, I think they would crawl over glass to do that. But I do think you can make an argument for Yuli Gurriel. I think Yuli is very underrated outside of just the counting stats that he has, outside of the conventional stats. It feels weird to say he had a breakout year for a guy who's 35 years old, but he did have, you know, he's only in his third year last year in the major leagues. He had a breakout second half last year. Seth, he's a guy who I trust in clutch situations. I think he's underrated defensively. I think he's underrated. I think his speed. He got down the line and beat out a few double plays the first few games of the year. And the big thing, $8.3 million a year. If I had assurances from Jim Crane and James Click that they would use whatever savings they were getting from not signing Brantley or Springer, that they were going to use them on something that was going to impact the team greatly. In other words, hey, look, we're going to take that extra $13, $14 million we're saving by not signing Springer, and we're going to go get another starting pitcher to put behind, hopefully, Verlander, but then Greinke and McCullers this year. Because I think you can find outfielders. And this year's free agency class, beyond Springer and Brantley, is actually a pretty deep class of outfielders. I think you can find outfielders for less than $20 million. They found Brantley for less than $20 million a year.
The thing about Yuli, and I feel bad for him sometimes, just, you know, minor feeling bad. He's doing all right in life. But I feel bad for him that people in America just don't appreciate and wouldn't appreciate, because they didn't see him playing in Cuba, just what a stud he was when he was a younger man.
Yeah.
And what an, you know, it's no surprise that he'd be a Golden Glove candidate at first base, because he's a hell of an infielder when he was a younger man. And I think that his kind of gimpiness when he slows down, that little hitch in his giddy up, leads people to believe that he's not as fast as he is. He kind of moves around like an older guy. But like you said, when he beat out that throw to first the other day, you could see that he can still move. I think all of that works in the Astros' favor, because that's probably the perception a lot of even personnel people in baseball might have Yuli as a little bit of an afterthought and almost check out on him because of his age before they even really start thinking about him. And I actually, John, my dirty little thought that I'm ashamed of was that if things were to turn south this year and perhaps the Astros weren't going to be contenders for whatever reason, boy, if Yuli had a minor injury and couldn't finish the season because of it, that might be good for the Astros. If just like maybe
drive his value down
a little bit. Yeah, yeah. I have other teams out there thinking like, well, he's old. Look at he's gimpy when he runs. We're not in the Yuli Gurriel race, and the Astros can give him a nice healthy contract.
Yeah, I actually think Yuli of these three guys, Seth, if you're asking me to handicap which of the three will be back, I feel like Yuli might have the shortest odds of coming back, because I feel like Springer. And maybe Brantley, if he keeps hitting the way Brantley normally hits. Springer especially, though. Like, Springer's going to hit his way out of this. Like, Springer is ultimately going to hit his way to being the number one outfielder on the market in the offseason. So with that assumption, I think Springer is going to be a guy who's still going to get paid pretty big money by somebody this offseason. Yuli is a middle-class player. Even though he was great last year, he's a middle-class player. I think he's the class, and he's 35, 36 years old. He's the classic guy who's going to get squeezed by the financial dynamics of this offseason.
You know who I worry about competing with the Astros for Yuli Gurriel?
Who?
Toronto Blue Jays.
Yeah,
they've got his brother Lourdes.
Yeah,
the Blue Jays, who once they do return to the country, the nation of Canada, then you know it's easier to travel between Canada and Cuba in some respects
right.
than it is between the U.S. and U.S. and Cuba. I that's the only thing I would worry about, is that there might be some kind of an emotional desire to get up there. But other than that, yeah, I think he'll be with the Astros.
I think he will too. So you made the argument for Springer. I made the argument for Yuli. Is there an argument to be made for Michael Brantley at 2 years, $30 million being the choice? A third of the people voting on it picked him.
I guess with Brantley, you
consistency
could
maybe.
And availability. I think that, you know, when Springer's running into the wall after the Astros already have a healthy lead. Yeah. How well is Springer going to age? Springer's a little bit like that guy that's still riding dirt bikes when he's 37. You're like, oh, why isn't Chuck at work this morning? Well,
he's wakeboarding.
He crashed off a berm, and he's still riding a two-stroke motorbike. And just, that's Springer. He might not be able to dial back the recklessness.
Yeah, yeah. The funny thing is, Brantley, you know, Brantley had a couple years there, and maybe this is why his value was down when he hit free agency a little bit. He played 11 games in 2016. He only played 90 games in 2017. He had 143 games a year before the Astros signed him, and he was an all-star both of those years. I just think you can find outfielders, and I get it. You're not going to find a George Springer, and you're certainly not going to find somebody in the clubhouse who's George Springer. But the Astros are going to have hard decisions in the offseason, Seth. That's just a fact.
There is no emotional attachment that James Click would have for George Springer, obviously, which is a point I think you brought up when it came to when it came to potential trades.
Kyle Tucker,
that the Astros might be entertaining. Like, Kyle Tucker was, you always got the sense that Kyle Tucker and Forrest Whitley were Jeff Luno's pride and joy,
yep.
And there's no way he would ever part with those. James Click. No emotional attachment.
No.
I think if somebody comes a calling for Kyle Tucker, then he might be up on the trade block.
No, there's no scraps in his scrapbook. He didn't even have a scrapbook. He just got here like in February. Yeah,
Kyle Tucker was untouchable. People would be, oh, remember when you would try to bring up the prospect of trading Kyle Tucker? People would threaten to do bodily harm to you. It was crazy.
Seth,
you get it? He's untouchable.
Seth, they called him Ted. His teammates got indignant when you wouldn't call him Ted because of his Ted Williams swing.
I've come over to that. It's a nice swing. It's a nice swing.
Oh, stop
like,
it.
It's beautiful.
Oh,
it's poetic,
God,
Sean.
Oh, Seth, don't do this.
Sean,
no,
Sean
Seth,
come on.
Not you. Not you. Seth. Why, Seth? Why?
What do you do? Yeah, what do you do if all you have is one part of a great player? You can't call him that whole player.
No.
It's just
not fair. Be the greatest hitter of all time.
Yeah.
All right.
Maybe like if I. Like, oh, I've got curly hair. Hey, you're Ron Jeremy. Like, nah.
Whoa,
Jeremy had more than just curly hair. You don't get to call yourself Ron Jeremy.
It's the same exact thing.
Hey, I'm fat. I'm Ron Jeremy.
Can you imagine you're that guy? Like, why does this guy keep calling me Ron at work?
So I told this woman that I was a lot like Ron Jeremy. I showed up, and she's all disappointed. And I'm like, hey, baby, I'm fat and with curly hair.
Curly hair?
What's your problem?
Frumpy as hell, yeah. We need to set some of these Los Angeles people straight on this Joe Kelly situation, including Jim Rome. We're going to do that next. It's been a fun first week of the season for baseball, Seth, for the Astros, just because there's been some stuff that's given us a few days to dig into. Like, there's been some noteworthy stuff. You know, I think more noteworthy for people here locally than nationally was Dusty's, obviously way more for locally than nationally, Dusty's strategy the other night, extra innings. Astro fans kind of swept up in that because they wanted to win that game. But the Joe Kelly thing was the lead story in sports for a day or two.
Yeah.
Not just the headhunting, but then the aftermath where he was suspended. And it still had a lot of people around baseball, certainly people in Los Angeles, but I think people around baseball, because I think most people are rooting against the Astros. It had everybody big mad that this team didn't get punished for stealing signs, and Joe Kelly's getting an 8-game suspension.
Ain't it crazy?
Yeah.
Just look, a lot of those people should be thanking their lucky stars that immunity wasn't offered in an investigation to their team.
Right. Yeah. And so what got me thinking about this yesterday, just when I thought it had died, Jim Rome did a Sports Minute. And I listened to it.
Are you going to make me listen to it?
I am. Seth, you and I, not only am I going to make you listen to it, but we're going to stop at a few points along the way so we can refute literally everything that he's saying in this Sports Minute. Like, everything he is saying from beginning to end, quite frankly, sounds like somebody who rips their chest open and the blood is just Dodger blue dripping down the front of their shirt and their crotch. So if you're ready, without further ado, here is yesterday. This happened during In the Loop. Jim Rome's Sports Minute on the Joe Kelly suspension.
I'm Jim Rome with a Radio.com Sports Minute. For the last 8 or 9 months, every single time I've started a minute with Major League Baseball announced, it has been followed by something truly idiotic. Check this. Major League Baseball announced the Dodgers pitcher Joe Kelly has been suspended 8 games for his role in the benches clearing incident in Houston on Tuesday night. As far as I can tell, he got suspended 8 games for not hitting somebody, not getting ejected, and making a face at a batter he struck out.
All right, pause, man. Pause. He got suspended for not hitting a batter, not getting ejected, and making a face at a hitter he just got out. All right, to be clear, he got suspended for when you say not hitting a batter, he threw at the guy's head. He didn't hit the batter probably because he has terrible aim and he's not a good pitcher. Not getting ejected, okay, well, now you're taking the umpire's incompetency and allowing Joe Kelly to shield himself from a suspension because of it, and making a face at a hitter he just got out. Yeah, it's called taunting. So, no. And he also got suspended, Seth, not just for headhunting, but he's been a jackass before.
Right, he's already been suspended once in his career for six games for hitting a batter.
Right.
So he's supposed to get suspended less now for trying to take off the heads of two batters, apparently, as well as acting like a general jackass in the midst of it and afterwards. Sure. That's what he's getting suspended for is all those other... Hey, Joe Kelly didn't even murder a nun the other night, and he's getting suspended.
Right.
Like, why don't you list all the things he didn't do, Jim Rome?
By that rationale, there should be no such thing as attempted murder. Like, you should only be, like, if you shoot a gun and you miss somebody, you shouldn't be arrested at all. There should be no punishment for that. You should only be arrested if you actually, the bullet actually pierces their skin. All right, continue.
Not getting ejected and making a face at a batter he struck out. Eight games in a 162-game season would have been insane. Eight games, though, in a 60-game season is bat bleep crazy.
Pause. Okay. We need to get past this, too, with Joe Kelly. The same way that suspensions for starting pitchers have some nuance to them because they only pitch every 5 days, an eight-game suspension for Joe Kelly is basically a three-game suspension. He pitches maybe every 3 days. He pitched 55 games last year for the Dodgers. So it's not like they suspended an everyday player. And oh, by the way, all these rosters have like 16 pitchers on the roster right now. If you're going to go to the... But that's like a 22-game suspension card. A big part of this punishment is the pay that these guys lose out on. And you brought up a great point. He got a 6-game suspension for the last time he did it. His per-game pay is still the same now as it was in a 162-game season. The pay is prorated now. So to me, a huge punishment is the pay that they lose out on. So therefore, you've got to use the same punishment metric as you'd use in a 162-game season.
We should just start applying this to everything in life, Sean.
Right.
If somebody gets arrested for DUI, his defense attorney should say, Your Honor, you can't possibly send this guy to jail for 3 months. There's a short baseball season. We need him back on the squad. Don't you get it, Your Honor?
Do you realize?
Are you dumb?
That's like 9 months of baseball.
He's like, yeah, this guy's got to get back out there.
Yeah.
I didn't say Joe Kelly is the guy that'll get the DUI, although it probably will.
Probably
be.
So. All right, let's continue.
Eight games, though, in a 60-game season is bat bleep crazy. So for the record, not a single Astro was suspended a single game for cheating, but a guy who does not play for them was just suspended 8 games for his role in the cheating.
Stop. Okay. Seth, do we need to explain immunity to these people again?
Apparently, we shouldn't bother. I mean, it's been damn near, half a year now, 6 months or so since this came out. And we knew there was immunity granted even before the results of the investigation were released. And yet somehow it's like fresh news to the Jim Rohns of the world every time it comes up. Oh, hey, by the way, so apparently what Jim Rome and all these other clowns want is that whenever anybody is granted immunity for anything at all, it means that everybody else is granted immunity in perpetuity.
Right.
Okay, so as long as basically, okay, so Sean, this is what happens. If somebody is granted immunity in some investigation against me and they don't have to go to jail for it, apparently for the rest of my life, I have the right to go up and just physically assault them because they were granted immunity.
Right.
Oh, wait a second. What? You're gonna actually expect me to abide by the law after you told that person he couldn't abide by the law?
And I think just to take it a step further, because I'm guessing there are a few listeners out there that might agree with Rome and may not understand why did they get immunity. Cody Bellinger, same thing. Like, I can't believe they granted them immunity. Bellinger, of all people, should know this. You're part of a union. And if the Astros all of a sudden were getting fined and suspended for something where there was not a rule for something, and now there are rules. Now, you know, Manfred, with agreement from the Players Association, has come down in the last 48 hours and said this will be a punishable offense now, using electronics to steal signs. That did not exist when the Astros got caught, so there would have been grievances. I mean, you think Deflategate got bad? I'm sure that the union, maybe, I don't know. The union, it's the union's job to stick up for its players, even if the other 29 teams feel, now the other 29 teams are probably like, yeah, we're doing that too, so we probably don't want to get too, you know, we probably don't want to get too upset over the Astros stealing signs. But the bottom line is, if they tried to suspend and fine the Astros in the wake of that with no rule in place, with no menu of suspensions in place for this sort of thing, the union would have taken Rob Manfred to the mattresses.
It really is, and honestly, this is where some of the players that are speaking up are really showing how dumb they are, like really genuinely how stupid they are, because they'll rail against Manfred in baseball for things that were actually a result of the union's influence. Like, Bellinger should be railing against his own players' union and not Rob Manfred. Rob Manfred's hands were tied in terms of how he could handle that investigation and whether he'd be able to punish the players at all. And yet Bellinger pipes up, or any of these other guys that pipe up, levying accusations at Manfred that are actually meant for or should be meant for their own union. And it's the height of idiocy. It's really astounding how dumb it is.
You sent me this tweet yesterday. Here's some audio here. We're done with the Jim Rome Sports Minute. This is from the Dodgers broadcast the other night after Altuve got – after the Dodgers – I believe it was after the Dodgers were able to get him out in this game. You're going to hear the Dodgers broadcast team and Oral Hershiser, former Dodger pitcher, making a snarky remark.
Strike three call. Perhaps guessing something else. Two out.
Guessing's harder than knowing.
Yeah. Guessing's harder than knowing. I love Preston Wilson, former Astro, retweeted that bit of video, and he said, I faced Oral when he pitched for the Mets, and everyone knew the way his pitches moved around was not normal. Our whole team knew it. So does he. The worst part was he had the audacity to send Bibles over to the clubhouse, autographed, if I remember correctly. Maybe not the best messenger. In other words, hey, Oral Hershiser, don't throw stones at glass houses, buddy. You were a cheater. And Brandon Porter, who is doing traffic today, he poked his head in before the show, Seth, and he said, hey, did you hear the Oral Hershiser audio? And I said, yeah, we got it lined up for the show. He pointed out that Oral Hershiser had a reputation of soaking his uniform with water. Like, he would douse himself with water so that he would not have to go to his hands for spit to make the ball move. Yeah.
Right. Which is, is that gamesmanship or is that cheating? I don't know. I saw this yesterday from Preston, and I kind of thought, like, all right, well, this is pitchers. This is about a pitcher, and pitchers use stuff. We all know it. For the most part, people just leave it alone. But what would it be about Oral Hershiser? Like, what could he get away with that was above and beyond that would make him do that stuff? I don't know. Would make it different than other guys that are using stuff. I don't know.
Yeah. So Oral Hershiser, keep your snark to yourself. And by the way, if you want to use your little snarky remark that you probably had on a note card waiting for just the right time, you keep your greasy verbal paws off of Jose Altuve. You can use it on anybody else, not Jose Altuve.
Here about Hershiser. Okay. In the 1997 playoffs, Hershiser threw 7 scoreless innings in a Cleveland Indians victory, leading opposing manager Davey Johnson to accuse Hershiser of cheating. Making matters worse, Hershiser's teammate.
It might be Chad OJ, I think. Yeah.
OJ, gosh dang it. Yeah. I haven't seen that in so long.
Yeah.
Chad O'Shea responded to Johnson's accusation by telling reporters after the game, he cheats and everybody else does. Why not? He showed me how to cheat, but he said, I can't do it until I'm about 35. So if I stay around that long, I get the privilege to cheat.
Yeah.
So there you go, Oral Hershiser.
Hypocrite.
Paragon of the game.
Hypocrite who delivers autographed Bibles to the clubhouse.
Autographed Bibles to other professional athletes,
right,
mind you.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It's one thing to autograph a Bible for a young baseball fan. Here you go, scamp. I'm going to put my favorite verse in there. He's giving it to other fellow professional athletes.
Last add to this topic before we get to headlines and Mark Vandermeer at the top of the hour. The voice of reason in all of this, Mad Dog Russo.
I am so tired of listening to everybody, and it's not just the players. It's Kasten, it's everybody. I can't take it anymore. Move on. Get over it. I am so tired of hearing the Dodgers moan and groan about the 2017 World Series against the Astros. First off, they lost 2 home games. How many times do they have to go through this? They lost 2 home games. Jansen vomited on himself. He spit up in game 2, and I like Jansen. Nice guy. But he vomited on himself in game 2. He couldn't get out of the 9th inning. Marwin Gonzalez hit the ball basically to the Hollywood sign. The Astros tie that game, and then the Astros won in the 10th inning. And then Darvish, wonderful Yu Darvish, worth $126 million, he went out there in game 7 and put his team in a 5-0 hole before he could even wake up. And they got killed. Springer hitting home runs and everything else. So the idea that the Dodgers now are going to sit there and continually to bemoan the sign stealing of the Astros in a World Series forgets conveniently the fact that the Dodgers should never have been in that situation to begin with. They lost 2 home games. It's not like the Dodgers haven't had chances to win championships. This team has stunk in a big spot for a long, long time. So now I'm supposed to make a big deal about a team that does nothing but lose big games in their building. I'm supposed to make a big deal about a game, and it's only one game. Game five. Remember, they won game four in that series in Houston. The only game that Houston lost in the postseason that year at home was to the Dodgers. But I'm supposed to go crazy that the Dodgers had a championship chip from them. Yet if you go back and watch the eighth and ninth inning in game two, they did nothing but throw up all over themselves.
Yeah. There you go. There you go. Mad Dog Russo. Seth, every time I hear Mad Dog, I think to myself, what does he sound like that, like just around the office, around the house? He's got a very distinct radio voice. My guess is some people like it, some people don't. He's been hugely successful, obviously, yeah. WFAN, and now he's got his own Sirius XM channel, which some of our friends work for from time to time. But I always wonder what Mad Dog seducing his wife. You know what I mean? Like, listen, baby, you look beautiful tonight. Mind if I unbutton your bra right now? And I vomit all over myself.
I think sometimes, too, like people accuse Mad Dog Russo of having face, faux outrage or whatever. Yeah. It's not like that at all. I think that's just his standard mode of being. That's just how he operates.
He's like that all the time.
It's like it sounds to us as a lot angrier than it actually is. That's just kind of the way he talks.
Right.
I will say, too, along those lines, I'll give a little bit more of a subdued argument about why the Dodgers can't seem to get over the top.
Yeah.
You can accuse the Astros or the Red Sox or anybody else of cheating all you want. There's a, like, Cody Bellinger, who's their best player, has a whole lot of the Clayton Kershaw in him. Cody Bellinger, through 3 years of playoffs and seven series, is batting 178 in the playoffs.
Yeah.
He has an OPS of 560 in the playoffs.
Right.
He's been awful in the playoffs. He's not a good playoffs baseball player. He's one of the best players in baseball, and yet he is absolutely sucked in the playoffs. You can't blame that on one series versus the Astros.
You know, Astro fans, just to put this in a context that you can understand poignantly from what's happened over the last week, think about how crappy Springer, Altuve, and Bregman have been hitting for this team so far this year, right? It pains you. It hurts in your gut. You're watching these guys. You're going, God, they look helpless right now. Cody Bellinger has a lower OPS in the playoffs than those guys do through the first six games of this year. That's what he's been like in the entire postseason of his whole career for the Dodgers so far.
Of his 145 at-bats in the postseason.
That's a lot! Holy
right,
crap.
Only 29 of them have been versus the Astros, and those were included home games. Plus, we all know that the Astros weren't cheating during the World Series. It was too loud. Like, go ahead and be at bat and try to decipher a tub thump from just all the other noise, the cacophony of sounds in the stadium. They just flat out weren't doing it. Cody Bellinger sucks in the playoffs.
Yeah.
And that's something that L.A. Dodgers fans need to come to grips with. Instead of pointing the finger at everybody else, realize that you've got three fat sausage fingers pointing back at yourself when you're pointing the finger at the Astros.
All right, let's do headlines. Mark Vandermeer, top of the hour.
And Pendergast. With today's headlines.
NBA restarted last night. Jazz, they beat the New Orleans Pelicans. And the Clippers go down to the Lakers in two games, Seth, that came down to the wire. Very exciting games. A lot of rust out there. And the environment was certainly different. The court surface was bigger. There aren't benches courtside anymore. There's really the first few rows of the stands that function as a bench where there's social distancing going on. I thought... Basketball players did a much better job of social distancing in bench environments than baseball players have so far. This is going to work for me, I think, is my big takeaway. And the Rockets, of course, get their season restarted tonight against the Dallas Mavericks. But this is going to work for me, Seth. It felt real enough to where I'm cool with it.
This is the only thing I would wish that maybe they could do. Because I don't want to be a beggar and a choosy here and complain too much about the experience. If they could figure out some way to have like more genuine crowd reactions or something, have a socially distanced watch party somewhere outside where you can kind of just jump into like a clip of the fans screaming and stuff in those big moments. I'm more of a much more of a social animal than I had thought or realized, Sean.
Yeah.
I really miss the communal experience of being part of a crowd, even if it's only on television.
I wonder if they start doing that, because some of these teams, obviously, their home base is back in states that are allowing people out. If there were a socially distanced watch party somewhere outdoor, I mean, the danger is that it becomes not socially distanced. But yeah, if they're all wearing masks and they're social distancing going, you know, similar, it would have to be back probably in the towns that host those, you know, where it would have to be back here in Houston, that kind of thing. But I know what you're saying, like where they cut to the outside of the arena for Toronto games and it looks bananas outside.
Yeah.
A socially distanced version of that where, like, for the Rocket game tonight, they cut back to Houston, you know, whether, you know, Discovery Green maybe or somewhere, and there's a bunch of Rocket fans watching on a movie screen, and Harden hits the three late in the game, and they're all going crazy, that kind of
thing. And I genuinely feel like a jerk for even asking for it. I'm grateful to have basketball, but that's my one little suggestion. If we could bring some of that into it somehow. I will say, I was impressed by the bench area. Yeah. And how well distributed everything was. That was better than I kind of... That was maybe the most jarring thing, was when you look at the bench and you don't see all these guys draped over each other trying to squeeze in there. I would imagine basketball players are probably going to... If I'm some guy that's 6'10", has spent my entire life squeezing into things, having to sit shoulder to shoulder next to other big guys for 2 hours every single night I play, that annoys the hell out of me. Once I've had a taste of it, these guys are sitting in first class now. It's going to kind of suck to go back to it.
It is. 8 o'clock tip tonight. Seth, you know what we're getting with this NBA schedule that I was hoping for is lots of weekday basketball. If you are an NBA junkie, you're going to get Magic and Nets, Seth. What a clash of the Titans at 1:30 today. Grizzlies Trailblazers at 3, Suns and the Wizards at 3. God, these are some really bad basketball teams. But if you
are what time is the first game?
1:30. If you are a degenerate gambler or a basketball junkie, this is a great time to be alive right now, because there are games from pillar to post from lunchtime to the end of the night for the next 2 weeks.
That's what somebody, I think it was Tyler Stafford on Twitter, brought this up yesterday. It caught my attention. Why is there not a baseball game being played at like 11 a.m. Central every single day?
Yeah, I don't know.
It seems like they might be missing out on at least one opportunity to have, if they had a nationally televised game in the afternoon, a matinee every day, I think they would probably get pretty good ratings.
I think it would. The only thing I would say, Seth, is that baseball is a game that's being played virtually every day. Like there's literally 5 off days over a 2 month period. So you start to do too many of these, and you get too many. There's already enough weirdness and variability being injected into this with the virus, the new rules, the truncated season, the big rosters, everything else. Now all of a sudden, if you, for TV purposes, are just injecting a bunch of day game after night game situations, then you're maybe jerking with the integrity a little bit. A little easier to do in the NBA.
Or you're jerking with the schedule, the biorhythms of these guys whose bodies are already going to be stressed quite a bit,
big
as we've
time.
Seen.
Yep. Next headline, make a note, 11 o'clock today on Sports Radio 610 Live, you will get Bill O'Brien and Jack Easterby. O'Brien at 11, Easterby advertised at around 11:30. I'm guessing it'll be right after O'Brien is done. Their first meetings with the media for training camp. And Easterby's first meeting, I believe, with the full assembled media in a public Zoom setting since he became the executive vice president of football operations. So a lot to dig into with both O'Brien and Easterby. Then there's Deshaun Watson and J.J. Watt tomorrow morning, Saturday morning. So 4 press conferences with 4 really important members of the organization in the next 24 hours or so. Seth, which of these 4 press conferences are you most looking forward to?
I am looking forward to Jack Easterby.
Same.
Because he has a much larger influence within the organization than I think most people realize. I think people in Houston are starting to get a feel for it. But I think outside the city of Houston, if they even know the name Jack Easterby, they don't realize that he is, whether you want to call him an assistant GM or almost maybe the quasi co-GM or whatever it is, he's got a huge influence in this organization. And this vision that Easterby and Bill O'Brien have created together is either going to boom or bust, you know, and Jack Easterby is going to be a huge part of it. I do think that Easterby has kind of worked his way into a pretty good catbird seat, Sean, where if it works out, he's going to get a whole lot of credit. If it crashes and burns, I don't think Jack Easterby gets much of the blame. He might, you know, like he might within, you know, Cal McNair will fire them both. But I think in the public at large, Jack Easterby's name only really gets known if this experiment succeeds.
I'm not so sure. I mean, I know they're attached at the hip, O'Brien and Easterby, functionally right now. But I don't know about that. If they if the Texans go 5-11 this year, you think they both go? Or, I mean, Easterby to me has enough going on behind the scenes where I could see where he'd be part, like, he might be well thought of enough to where he would be part of the next coaching search.
If he goes, if they, well, for one, I think if the Texans go 5-11, then it gets really interesting. I think Bill O'Brien only gets fired if Cal's got somebody lined up already.
Okay.
But I think that O'Brien, because he's been the GM for only one full calendar year now, I think that it's almost like a grace period again, which I know. Yeah. It doesn't seem right. That's the way it feels to me this year.
I don't even want to think about 5-11. All right, next headline. College football is starting to take shape. Three of the Power Five conferences, up until a couple of days ago, had still not disclosed how they're going to execute their seasons. We know that the Big Ten was the first to say, we're playing a conference schedule only. The Pac-12, literally, like right on the heels, same day, said, we are going to do the same thing. Now, the Pac-12 is set to announce their schedule very, very soon, but we got some clarity over the last 2 days as to what two of the other three conferences are going to do. As we dug into yesterday, Seth, the ACC is going to play a 10-conference game plus one non-conference game schedule, and they're going to bring in Notre Dame as a member of the conference for 1 year only. A big reason why the ACC added that one non-conference game was because four or five teams in the league have an annual rivalry with a team in the SEC that plays in their state. Louisville and Kentucky, yeah. Clemson and South Carolina, Florida, Florida State, Georgia, Georgia Tech. There's a lot of games like that with the ACC. So the ACC did that going, well, at least we'll get to keep these games. The SEC basically just kind of thumbed their nose at it and yesterday settled on a 10-game conference-only schedule. So now the ACC is going to stick to their 10-plus-1. That plus-1 is going to be some weird out-of-conference game that they're going to have to go find. But the SEC, I think that was the one everybody was waiting for, Seth. What is the SEC going to do? They're going to do a 10-game conference-only schedule. The Big 12 will make their announcement early next week as to what they're going to do.
And just by way of giving an explanation real briefly, because every time one of these conferences announces this, I see the same responses on Twitter, which is, oh, apparently only other conferences get the COVID. This is how you're going to be safer. It's really about scheduling. It's that you anticipate you're probably going to have to reschedule some games or postpone or what have you. So they figure that first you lop off the non-conference games. That opens up a bunch of weekends here and there. And then after that, they take more drastic measures. I will point out that the LSU-Rice game, the battle that was to be, I will mourn that forevermore. This is the year.
LSU is ducking Rice, basically.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I mean, it goes to show you how much power and how much clout Ed Orgeron has now.
That's right.
That he can get the entire conference to abandon non-conference game just so he can duck Rice.
The one interesting part about this SEC thing, Seth, is they're not going to start this schedule until September 26th. Whereas the Big 12 has come out, at least a few schools have come out and said, we're going to play a non-conference opponent in week zero now. Like Oklahoma has said, our Missouri State game, we're moving it up a week to August 29th. The SEC is doing the exact opposite. And they're building in a couple extra weeks within the schedule where now the SEC title game is not going to take place till December 19th.
I just had a flashback, Sean, to the Ivy League in football starts way late every year. Our first game is usually like September 20-something because you're supposed to, you know, you got to get your schoolwork in order, all that nerdy stuff.
Yep.
But it was always like every single year in the NFL, I dreaded it. It was so embarrassing because like you're sitting in the D-line meeting room and, you know, Gary Walker's talking about Auburn. And, you know, somebody else is talking about Clemson or something. And they'd be like, so, Seth, when how'd your school do? Where'd you go there? Cortland, Cornell? And I'd be like, they don't play for another 3 weeks. So that's right. What? And then we'd have to stop, and I'd have to explain the whole situation every year. 10 straight years I had to do that.
Normally I would say, Seth, well, good. If you were in the NFL this year, then your embarrassment wouldn't be nearly as much because the SEC's not starting until September 26th. However, now if they were to ask you that question this year, they'd be like, so does your season still start on the 26th? You'd be like, no, it doesn't start at all. It starts in the spring. They canceled
maybe.
It. Yeah, maybe.
We'll see. Yeah.
Maybe. Last headline, and then we'll get to Mark Vandermeer for his Friday visit with us. LeSean McCoy, Shady McCoy, signs a 1-year deal with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Shady McCoy, it's kind of people made a big deal out of it last year when he signed with the Chiefs. Like, oh, look, Andy Reid and reunited with Shady McCoy. And then he wasn't even active for the playoffs. But he is signing with the Tampa Bay Bucs. Seth, is Gronk basically forcing a trade to the Bucs and now McCoy going there? Are these kind of Brady's first recruits, do you think, or is McCoy washed? Does he have anything left at this point?
Boy, you know, it's funny. I was listening to an old fantasy broadcast from last year when McCoy signed with the Chiefs, and people were talking about what a big factory he was going to be. I don't know.
Inactive.
I don't think. Yeah, exactly. And I'm not going to count him out because I learned that lesson with Adrian Peterson, right?
Yeah.
Adrian Peterson looked washed with the Saints. When we saw Adrian Peterson with the Saints, you thought, like, oh, all right, that's pretty much it for him. And here he is with a new contract with the Washington Redskins. Excuse me, the Washington football team.
Yeah.
So, no, I will not say. I think Shady McCoy can always do damage to you.
Yeah.
I think it is evidence of that whole hey, I'm going to go to New England because that's my best shot at winning a Super Bowl, and I'm old and I don't care how much money I make. That's now been transplanted down to, oh, it was always about Tom Brady and not Bill Belichick.
You are listening to KILT and KILT HD2, a radio.com station. People are making Mad Dog requests now. Text message, Mad Dog as a priest during your confession, hashtag Mad Dog Dialogues. Why are you cheating on your wife? You must say 10 Hail Marys. All right. I grew up listening to Mad Dog. Mad Dog's gimmick back in the day that I remember, he was on with Francesa. That was the pairing for years. There was a 30 for 30 about it. The thing that always made me and my brother laugh listening to Mad Dog in the car was when they would bring up callers. And Mad Dog, his whole thing was shortened version of the name and then long version of the name. And what I mean by that, he'd go, let's go to Yonkers and talk to Mike. How you doing today, Michael? You know, like he would, you know, like, so it was really, really funny. It was,
would he only accept calls from syllabic callers?
So my brother and I used to like take names that couldn't be made into polysyllabic things. And we would imitate Mad Dog and do it. Like, your name is that, Seth. We'd be like, let's go to New Rochelle and talk to Seth. How you doing today, Seth Tavius?
I see it, by the way. That didn't go unnoticed, you flexing by pronouncing that polysyllabic or whatever word
effortlessly. Yeah.
After I'm pulling a
polysyllabic, yeah.
Polysyllabic.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.